The Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grey Cricketer podcast on Fox Sports. The second test, it is done, it is dusted, Australia 2-0 up, and wow, there are so many things to take away from this game. We thought after the first test that there were many things to speak about. Adelaide's just thrown up all sorts of curveballs here. Joe Root's decision to win the toss and bowl, Steve Smith's follow-on decision, all the sledging that happened, the reviews, the ups, the downs, Alain Dar getting it wrong all the time, and the other New Zealand bloke, the umpire whose name escapes me. That's good research. Kate McGregor, we're trying to get Kate McGregor on the podcast today, live from Adelaide, but as you know, everyone's trying to get out of Adelaide, so that could be mayhem. But the big news this week is that Mark Butcher is on the show, and we're going to get his opinions on Ashes and also what's happening in India and Sri Lanka. That's a wild series in itself. My name is Ian Higgins, and I am joined, as ever, by my friends, your friends, Australia's friends, Sam Perry and David Edwards. Boys, welcome to the show. Adelaide, Australia, 2-0 up. Is this series over, Sam Perry?
Getting more elaborate by the week. I love it. And even though it was an elaborate and wonderful introduction, he goes again, I have to pick you up on one thing. You've missed something. And that was, I see, you know, you're holding a pen. This is bad radio, but you're holding a pen as you talk. This is a new style that I picked up following your appearance on Bill and Boz on Fox Sports the other night. Is this something... Is this a new look for you, just to hold a pen whenever you're talking?
Yeah, it just sort of gives the impression that I'm taking notes, even though I'm not.
What about the tweed jacket? No, I'm not quite sure why you're wearing a tweed jacket, though.
I thought you explained what happened in the test pretty well. He goes, test cricket. I mean, 5 days, 4 days, it threw up so many storylines, so many narratives to throw that klaxon in there straight away. I woke up at 3:30 a.m. this morning, UK time, very much expecting an historic day of test cricket. I'll say it, and I know it's not popular to admit you're wrong, especially in hindsight, which is a huge theme of this week's cricket, but I thought that England... we're going to do it. I just thought everything about what had happened the day before, the momentum that England had wrested violently from Australia, the way the Australians had gifted like a passage back into the game for England, meant that you know, this was Root's chance to become a hero. I thought all he needed was 100, just that's all he needed. And I thought he was going to do it. Instead, two early wickets to Hazelwood by England. They're completely fucked now.
Well,
David Edwards, did you think you were going to do it? England were going to do it, right?
I didn't actually think I was going to start speaking on this podcast. How many minutes have passed? 4 or 5 minutes? Good to be with you as always, boys. No, I mean, honestly, I was hoping desperately that Root would kick on this morning and make something of it, and someone could just hang around with him, and who knows what could have happened. We were scared, weren't we? We were scared that that the English were going to pull out a miracle. Obviously, they didn't. But it was a test match completely full of moments. I mean, day one, we were giggling about how silly England was for sending us in. You know, they were scared of facing Australia on a juicy Adelaide wicket. And then there was the other moment where Sean Marsh reviewed his LBW decision. That was overturned. He went on to make a ton, a historic ton. Then Australia resold England. Then we decided not to enforce the follow-on. As an aside, I always love how the follow-on is enforced. Fuck, it just makes it sound alpha as fuck. But that was an anti-climax because Australia won the match easily and Smith's decision was justified. But, geez, what a test match. What a test match.
I like that you're picking up on this theme of fear because fear really governs all, doesn't it? I want to ask you guys, honestly, as the match kind of turned England's way fractionally as they were kind of 3 for 170. It was Milan and Root in. I was at work, and a lot of my UK colleagues were listening to the show. What did you really want to happen? Like, you know, what do you want deep down as an Australian? Like, do you want a bloody 5-0 whitewash? Good evening, England. I want every element of you to be destroyed for various post-colonial reasons? Or was there a part of you that thought, well, it would be great if they squared the series and we can go into a live, you know, a live post-Christmas test set of fixtures and get that man-cad that we wanted Pat Cummins to get? What did I want to be honest. Like, I want you to be honest. Like, what did you really want?
So what I wanted, I said openly that I wanted England to win. Like, I really wanted England to win because I thought 1-1 going into Perth, Ben Stokes is going to play in Perth. I think that's everyone. I don't hear anyone saying that he's going to play in Perth except for us three. I think he's going to play in Perth. So I thought 1-1 going into Perth, like Stokes comes back, and then even though he's obviously horribly out of form from his four and none for in New Zealand county cricket. I just thought that's what I wanted. But then when Hazelwood took a wicket this afternoon with his second ball dismissing the overnight batsman Wokes, I did give it a fist pump. I gave it a fist pump. So, like, you know, old habits die hard. Like Australia is the team that I want to win the Ashes. But I thought openly that I wanted England to win this game, but then I fist pumped reactively. Yeah. So I don't know what to believe anymore.
I mean, I'm the same as you, he goes. Like, I wanted 1-1 going into the third test. I wanted competition. I wanted the Ashes to be alive. Mm. But I also, like, made an involuntary yelp last night when, you know, when a couple of wickets fell. I just found myself, I couldn't help it. It was something innate and visceral that sparked inside me. I just hate England, and I didn't even know it. This Ashes series is really making me despise them even more and more, even though hello to our English listeners.
Yeah, hello to Mark Butcher down the track. I know exactly what you mean, Dave, as well. And now that it's 2-0, does that mean it's incumbent upon us to make it 5-0? Like, now that the kind of, I mean, the series is still alive, even though we go to Perth and for all intents and purposes is dead. It's kind of clinically dead, isn't it?
Clinically.
Without the So what has it got to become now? Like, does it, for it to become a kind of memorable series in any way, shape or form, does it have to become 5? Is the worst result a sort of 3, Australia go up 3-0 and then James Vince scores a big 100 in a dead rubber Sydney test, which tends to be what happens? What happens now?
Oh, well, I mean, cricket is a binary sport, isn't it? I mean, it's all or nothing. Something's the best thing ever or the worst thing ever. So obviously we need to win 5-0 for this to be a win from now on. You know, a 3-2 victory or a 3-1 victory with a draw, it's just not going to be enough for us. It won't satiate us the way that a 5-0 whitewash. We need whitewash to whitewash. We need Daniel Bretig-style destruction of England.
So, I mean, without skipping too far ahead, when we have just summed up the entire series, but, like, are we giving England any chance in Perth? Because, like, Joe Root's come out today and he said that in the press conference after the match, and he said that one thing that has been shown is that England are in this series and they're in it hard. I paraphrased there just to make it Australian, but he's basically saying that Australia, England are still in the series, but are we giving them any chance at all in Perth?
No.
Oh, it's pretty difficult to do that now, isn't it, Higos? Like, I was thinking about this Adelaide test because it became so engrossing, it became easy to forget that there was a lot about this test match that was in England's favour.
Yeah.
You know, they won the toss, for starters. They were in conditions that were more favourable to them than any other conditions they're going to get in Australia, and arguably more favourable than they were to Australia as well, given when they bowled, etc. You know, they dismissed Steve Smith relatively cheaply, which I suppose isn't a favourable thing. They earned that. You know, he probably erred in following on or not. I know we'll talk about that. I mean, he kind of semi-admitted that this evening. So with that in mind, and Australia still emerging 120-run victors, it's and now going to Perth, which is the most alpha Australian wicket of all. Although, is that a myth?
It's a myth.
You know, yeah, but I guess myths... Myths kind of endure, don't they? If someone says, perception is reality, if someone says that it's an alpha Australian wicket, then England really are in trouble, aren't they? So I just think if they couldn't do it in Adelaide, gee, it's going to be pretty hard for them to do it in Perth.
I mean, and our bowling attack is just so menacing right now. Like, I don't remember. You got to go back to, like, the great old days of, you know, McGrath, Gillespie, Lee to remember such a penetrating and fast attack. I mean, even Hazelwood, he was bowling in the high 140k range this test. And Australia's three pace bowlers are all kind of near enough to 150k, sometimes even above. Whereas you got Anderson Broad, low 130s. That's like a 15-20k difference.
Dave, yeah.
That's seriously substantial. Then you got Lyon, who's getting great shape. Our attack just hasn't looked this good in years. So, Did I say it's going to be 5-0, 6-0, 7-0?
All right, lads, let's move on to the sledging. There were too many instances to name individually in this test match. There was a bunch of just sledging incidents that sort of almost like came to a head last night when Tim Payne said words to Joe Root, who Joe Root then like pointed his bat at Tim Payne, Australia's wicketkeeper, and it looked very aggressive. But I mean, from my own personal perspective, before I get you guys to jump in here, I thought it was fucking great that England were just like giving it back to Australia, because I think like this, so much of this series so far has been just like, oh, you're being mean to us. Why are you being mean? And like, that's not going to win you any friends in Australia. I mean, England are right. Why are you being mean? but it's just...
Yeah, it's a fair question.
I don't think it's not going to win you test matches in Australia. Like, you have to give it back to Australia. And I think that Australia's reaction to it is just like, well, hang on a second. We dished it out, but we don't take it very well. And like, Australia's reaction to it was just like, whoa, hang on a second. But I thought it was fucking great when like Broad was like getting stuck into Hanscom and Anderson was giving it back to Smith and whatever else. I want to ask you guys, I mean, what do you think about the sledging matchups throughout the game?
Yeah, I think you're completely right in the way you characterise Australian sledging. You know, we'll kick it off and say everything under the sun, but as soon as someone stands up to us, like, what the fuck are you talking about? Yeah. What'd you say? What'd you fucking say about me? What'd you fucking say about our mates? About my wife? You know, you're completely right, he goes. And, like, look, I think there's a delineation that needs to be made. I don't think the sledging makes too much of a difference on field to the kind of quality of the cricket. Mm. But I do think that it's important that if you're playing against Australia that you do stand up to them. You know, even if you lose or whatever, I don't think anyone's walking away or any Australians are walking away from this going, oh, look, England shouldn't have sledged. They got distracted. I think you do have to do it for your own sense of dignity. Mm. And also, let's remember that, like, I think the Ashes is quickly becoming less a series in itself, home and away, and more like who can win by more at home. So even if, like, England lose here 5-0, if Australia walk away from that thinking, well, they are going to take us on and they're not scared of us, they'll probably beat us at home, you know, and people will enjoy it over here in the UK, you know, in a few years. So they're still striking blows 2 years in advance.
Well, I just think it was a great sledging matchup, and Anderson just has one of those faces, doesn't he? Like, there's just something about his face. And it's the same with Broad. Like, they're just such quintessential villains to us, probably because they're neatly manicured, they've got good bone structure, and, you know, that intimidates us as Australians, so we want to sledge them even harder. Mm. I actually really liked it when Anderson started fielding at short mid-on. Did you see that when he was kind of right in Steve Smith's running path as the non-striker? So it really was just one of those annoying passive-aggressive things that make cricket what it is. Like, you're not only you're just getting in the striker's eye line, but you're also obstructing the non-striker's running path. Like, it's just cricket. Just being annoying.
And you just know that, like, you know, they turn down the stump mics or whatever, but you'd like to think that the players representing your nation in sledging are winning the battle, but the rational part of me just doesn't think that will be the case. I don't really know what they would be saying, but I just can't see...
The Hansard record of what's being said, just written out on a piece of long paper, and just go through it, you know, with a cup of coffee and just digest it all.
That's probably the next step, isn't it, in this sort of data journalism era? I mean, who's going to do the data journalism or the transcript of sledging? I think there's a market for that.
Russia, definitely, Pez. I want to ask you guys about sledging. Like, a lot of people, like, the sort of the revert to answer is like, it's not a good look for the game because there are kids watching the game. But then, like, as soon as anyone who's 13 plays great cricket, the first thing they get, like, they just get hammered sledging. Like, do we, like, I mean, somebody please think of the children, obviously, is a Simpsons quote that we're all thinking, but who cares about the children, really? I mean, is the game reliant so much that we care about what the children think that these guys can't say, like, abhorrent things to each other? I don't know what my question is, but what do you guys think?
It is amazing how much at, like, the professional level, clearly they value sledging as a tool to get an edge. Yes. Mm. Like, can you imagine making that much money playing cricket and, like, just literally eating cricket balls and hitting cricket balls all the time and being so drilled in, like, bodily movements for cricket that, like, Jimmy Anderson... But Jimmy Anderson standing at short mid-on and getting in your running path is actually going to distract you. Like, that these words can actually have an impact. Like, doesn't it show how soft we all are, really? Like, if someone sledges you and they think it works, they must, like, yeah. It's kind of like tacit admission that they think you're, like, just an insecure person. Mm. I don't know, mate. Although, having said that, I still remember the first time I got sledged with a swear word in under 16, so I can't believe it took so long, but playing against Parramatta in Green Shield, and I got caught at first slip, and their captain, as I walked off, said, fuck off, prick. And I was like, prick? Like, prick is such a word for an adult.
Yeah.
When I was 15, I was
slightly
like,
slightly sanitized.
At like age 15.
I remember when I played against a team from the Western Suburbs at home, and I got out and he told me to fuck off back to the beach. And I was playing in Chatswood. Like, we were nowhere near the beach.
It's he good just advice. Didn't know.
I actually recall that game very well, Eddos. I want to ask you guys quickly before we move on to our next segment, but Sean Marsh is a guy who has polarised opinion in many ways. He scored 100, and he's like, he's done it again just to make a binary, is that he's now everyone's favourite player. But the shot that he played in the second innings was, for lack of a better term, yuck. So, I mean, now that he's scored 100, is he going to Prime Minister Australia, or is like, what's the deal? Like, where are we at with Sean Marsh, Pez?
Well, I think the first thing that has happened as a result of this is that they've called Mitchell Marsh his brother into the side. So yes. I think that's the first benefit he's received, is your brother can play. Yeah. So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw him and Hanscom might make way. So it's like he scores his 100, and now the selectors love him so much. Like, oh, we can bat with your brother now. I think that part is good. But we got to see that just that immaculate cover drive, and then it was completely iced by him straight driving broad over his head for six to end the game, to that end the innings alpha. Not out, and just to walk, turn his back and walk off. It was such a great innings, Sean Marsh's innings. It was, it was just, like, Australia hasn't scored centuries with meaning for a long time. I feel like a lot of our centuries are sort of second innings, or when we really got our foot on their throat, or it's too easy. Yeah. But, you know, Smith's last test followed by Marsh's under pressure again is something that, like, you can only applaud.
I mean, Sean Marsh, we've actually got a question later in the episode, which we might just answer now. It says, did Sean Marsh just alpha the Australian public? And I think he did. Like, and he did it in a really quiet, understated way that's just in character for him, which is the best type of alphaing. Like, no words, just actions. He went out there. He knows his game now. He's got a beautiful cover drive. And he just made the most of his opportunity. And now, as you said, he gets to bat with his brother, which is the best thing you can do in cricket.
And if he's alphaed all of us, we are now therefore his submissive, aren't we?
That's the only way. That's the way it works, yeah. Someone needs to be alphaing someone else. Binary.
And that question did come in from Cameron Orshawn. Thanks for the question, Cameron. So basically, Australia's now has got the ball gag in our mouth, and Sean Marsh is our daddy. I think that's what we're all saying. Fantastic news for this podcast. We've got a couple of new sponsors on board this week, and you're about to hear a little advertisement that we put in this week, and here it is.
Meet Nugsy. As he orders a Dutch beer and a Japanese brothel, he checks his exclusively Australian My Cricket stats. But more on that contradiction later. Every morning he crawls out of his single bed in a global world, hungover as fuck, barely noticing his ciggies are German, his yellowing 93 Subaru is Japanese, and his favourite protein powder manufactured from the USA. He thinks nothing of chatting with Taiwanese women on OkCupid, while attempting to buy a new stick online with an overdrawn UK debit card, before getting caught up in yet another email phishing scam out of Nigeria. It hardly registers that he buys his $1 machine coffee from an American-Japanese convenience store, catching up on the cricket scores en route to meet his ex-wife at a solicitor's office in Chinatown. Unfortunately, the truly global nature of Nugsy's world only becomes apparent when he realises he's wasted his entire life savings on Australian-grade cricket. From rego fees to training kit, new sticks to post-match circuits. Not to mention a debilitating gambling addiction that has literally cost him everything. Lost everything to cricket? Might as well park some coin in a global managed fund that you don't really understand anyway. Columbus. The global investment experts.
It's very satisfying to introduce this next bloke to the show. Just some numbers for you, because that's all we really are.
Numbers,
after all, just numbers. 71 tests, highest test score of 173 not out, 280 first-class matches, 17,870 first-class runs. He's the first ever test captain we've ever had on the show. But there's more. He's a genuine guitarist and songwriter, not in the Brett Lee Shane Watson mold. He's making actual genuine records, not six and out records. But more importantly than all of that, he was one of the very first people to follow the grade cricketer, more important than being England captain, which actually gave me a way to show my then girlfriend that I wasn't wasting my life and that this anonymous account had legs. I'm of course talking about Mark Butcher. Mark, welcome to the grade cricketer and thanks for liking us.
Oh, mate, it's an absolute pleasure. Now, you know, when I first saw your post on Twitter, it did make me chuckle quite heavily. I don't know whether you know, but I played grade cricket for a whole summer for South Melbourne back when they were at the Lake Oval back in 93, 94.
Oh, wow.
So, all the stuff you talk about is extremely familiar to me. And, does cause me to chuckle more than once.
How did you find your South Melbourne experience? So was that the first time you'd come to Australia? Or was it kind of a crude awakening into Australian men?
No, mate. It was a lot of fun. I stayed with a great family, the McWhirters, the father of which ended up being sort of like a convener of selectors for Victoria.
Yeah.
And you know, it was just I got the full experience. Damien Fleming was sort of like the state player, him and Wayne Phillips, actually, not the wicketkeeper Wayne Phillips, but the opening batsman. And it had all of the characters that you see in the great cricket. You know, had the sort of like the journeyman all rounder who'd been around it, played up in Queensland, played everywhere, loved a beer, was just, you know, didn't train, but, you know, had all of the stories and none of the stats. A 40-odd year old leggy who had glory days abound in the past, but was again another one sort of selected on past glories and stuff, and they were all really, really great guys. And It did wonders for my career, actually, just that 6 months over there.
Oh, mate, that's brilliant and pretty much shows up our research. Perhaps it was hard to come across that research because you've done so much in the game since. I mean, while we're on sort of Australian grade cricket, it's the first time we've ever really spoken to an international player, sort of current or former, of significant repute. Like, how would you contrast at least amateur or a semi-professional cricket in Australia versus England? I mean, is there a lot of overlap in the cultures and the characters that you come across, or is the stereotype of the crude Aussie player, in a league of its own?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you guys would like to think so because of, you know, that Australian cricket exceptionalism that rings out through throughout your entire game.
Love it.
But no, I mean, your characters are everywhere. You know, they're right the way through, club cricket and sort of even overlapping the professional game a little bit as well, but particularly sort of the amateur game. That's why it rings so true. That's why it has me laughing as much as it does, because all of the stuff, being selected because you might get the odd shag at the weekend or whatever, and all of those things are all just like they're just 100% cricket, no matter where you are. You know, maybe not in Pakistan, but but I'm guessing in the sort of the Anglo-Saxon cricketing world, I think it's pretty much transferable.
That's a wonderful answer. Good. And so, I mean, you do say that everyone's the same. I'm not sure if there's similar kind of self-awareness over here, like that you're able to bring. I wanted to pick up on that, Butch, because, and I will call you Butch, because we've known each other for 3 minutes.
Well, that's
but there's a fantastic interview between you and Felix White in what was previously known as All Out Cricket. It's now Wisden Cricket Monthly. Anyone who hasn't read it should get on there and read it. It's there. It's fascinating. And Felix himself is a guitarist and a songwriter in the Maccabees, and you're incredibly open about the sort of bloke you were playing cricket and really self-aware of it. And I just want to quote one or two things and get your thoughts on it. You said you virtually invented this complete dickhead character who would do whatever he wanted whenever he wanted. He's going to have as much fun as he can playing cricket outside of cricket as well, and if it lasts, it's going to last. And I think a lot of guys would identify with that in cricket, perhaps not being as good as you were. And You also said, and I'll finish in a second, that you decided, you know, that if it means I'm going to be a total, and I will say it here, and I apologise in advance to anyone who's offended, but it's a cricket word, going to be a total cunt, then that's what I'll do. It was a it was brilliant a lot of the time. A lot of the guys would identify with that too. Can you tell us a little bit more about this alter ego butcher character?
Yeah, I mean, he was a character that kind of that lived me more outside of being a cricket player. I mean, I still when I turned up for work as first time meeting for Surrey, being a team man, not being a dickhead while I was at work and trying to, you know, all having the same sort of goals while you're playing, that remained. It was the way I behaved with you know, with people and the relationships that I had. You know, outside of the game, that changed, because and the excuse I make for it, and you know, I kind of hate myself even saying it now, was that if I was gonna kind of be the best that I could be, that I couldn't afford to have time for anybody else's shit, you know. And the first time I had a go at the international arena, I was married, and I kind of, you know, and I was a bad husband and father and those things. And you know, that was kind of part of what brought me down in the first place, was that I realized I couldn't be, you know, I couldn't be the good dad at home, do all that kind of stuff, and do what I wanted to do as a cricket player. So I thought, well, I need to jack all that side of it in and just indulge myself as much as I possibly can in order to get where I want to be as a cricket player. And you know, and that's basically what I did. In the process of doing that, I sort of resurrected my career, but then also destroyed it at the same time. You know, there was a kind of an arc, and it, you know, by the time I got to the back end of it, I was a shell of a bloke again. You know, when I ended up outside the international team, which was, you know, due to injury more than anything else. But I'd kind of, you know, I was drinking heavily. I had another child with another woman that I wasn't seeing, you know, just everything was a complete and utter disaster. So the same guy that kind of helped me initially brought me down in the end anyway. So when I look back on it, I just think that I'd love to have had another go. I'd love to have had the sort of perspective I have on life and on, you know, on the goals that you have for yourself, in the way that I had now. But you know, I was a mess. I was your guy here. I was your guy, and you know, and in parts of it, it was great, and in a lot of parts of it, you know, guys sort of look back on their careers and sort of say they don't have any regrets, so they wouldn't do anything differently. Well, I'd do a lot of things differently.
Oh, it's like
in the midst
we,
of all of that, I had a great time.
It's like what we say a lot on this podcast is give up everything for cricket or be happy. There's only two. There's only two crossroads there. Take one or the other.
Yeah.
Butch, you were dropped from the side, I think, in 2000 for the first time. And you actually found yourself playing seconds at Surrey. And I read that you worked with your father, Alan, who himself played a test and was a county player of quite a lot of repute, to kind of sort out your form. And then you made it back in on the test side for the Ashes in 2001. So I'm just wondering, what did you kind of work on during that interval period with your dad to get you all the way from second grade to the test side? Because I think all cricketers out there are wondering that.
Okay, well, first and foremost, I stopped having
throwdowns.
I changed everything, really. I said to him, fathers and sons aren't supposed to work together on things like this. But I said to him, look, I need help. Just treat me like I've never played before, and I won't get in your way, type thing.
Wow!
And it managed to work out from there. So literally, like grip, stance, backlift, the whole thing.
So your dad just had this absolute license to treat you as harshly as he possibly could. It wasn't just gentle throwdowns after dinner each night. It was like the full putting you through the works just to get you back in that test side.
Just to get me playing well enough that I wouldn't quit, that I would enjoy it, you know. You know, the other stuff happened almost by accident. There were lots of happy accidents that happened along the way, mainly to other people getting injured and things like that, that meant that I ended up back in the team. But that was not the goal in the first place. You know, and it was brilliant. I would you know, I'd recommend to anybody, any sort of grade guy that kind of wants to do something about that, actually genuinely wants to do something about the way they play, as opposed to talk shit about it in the bar afterwards. That, you know, that there is nothing wrong with kind of changing things that you'd always done, you know, because you can do it. You just have to give over quite a bit of time to it, but it can be done, and it can pay dividends.
I thought you were going to say there, Butch, that if anyone was struggling with their game, to let their dad break them down and rebuild them back up again. But I'm not sure.
That's what I deduced from that.
Yeah, from everybody. Yeah. Can we? Yeah.
You know what? I wouldn't do that.
just fast forwarding to the cricket that's just taken place as we speak. Australia has just taken a 2-0 lead following the defeat of England at Adelaide. I'm obviously in London. Butch, I believe you're somewhere close by to that as well. When you got up this morning to watch it, did you go straight back to bed?
Well, I would have done had I not been working on what was an incredibly entertaining 5-day snore fest between India and Sri Lanka in Delhi. So I had the screen on with the Ashes test, and I was also watching an incredible game of Test match cricket. Isn't cricket a stupid game, right? On the one hand, you've got, you know, everybody that loves the Ashes going, oh, you know, this just proves that Test match cricket is the most wonderful game in the world, and you know, anybody that doesn't love it has got something wrong with their heart. And then on the other side of the world, just the worst game that you've ever seen on a terrible pitch.
Yeah, it can be really
proving
bad.
The exact opposite. You know, isn't that the game?
Yep.
Yeah.
See, that's the alarm going off, just to warn you about that game. Don't watch it, whatever you do.
It is funny, isn't it? I think with this Ashes, you're totally right. Everyone said, look, Test cricket's still alive and well. I do wonder how much people will have enjoyed the kind of scoring at 2 or 2.5 runs and over had there not been that kind of tradition of tribalism between Australia and England. You know, that half the enjoyment of the arm wrestle is everything that goes with it contextually between both nations. I was just going to say, Butch, you know, so that we can talk about tactics and what's actually happening in the game, and I don't know what it is about this podcast. We tend to keep getting left-handed top order batsmen on the show, at Cowan, Quiney, Rogers. I wanted to get your thoughts on England's top order in Australia.
You got some blokes who can really play there.
Would you make any changes to the order or the personnel of England's top order? And I suppose I include Ben Stokes in that conversation.
You put Ben Stokes back in the side, and it sold a lot of cheese. But he scored a lot of runs at number 7 when he'd had Stokes above him and Moeen Ali and Chris Wokes behind him. But of course, you know, Johnny now at 7 is kind of hung out there on his own quite a lot. So that changes. Stokes not being there changes his effectiveness there. There's an issue with England's top order. There has been for ages. So they've been looking for somebody to partner Alistair Cook. They've been looking for a 3. They've been looking for a number 5. And all of those scenarios still hold true, I think. With what England got in terms of the squad, Derek Vance could back in, I suppose. Would he do any better than James Vincent, number 3? Maybe not. Probably not. And the only other thing to do, the only sort of glaring thing to do really, is to move Johnny Bairstow to number 5. Now, I've been saying he should bat 5 for goodness knows how long, for the last 2 years. That would mean taking the gloves off him and bringing Ben Folks into the he's a very good transfer, but he's probably a bat or something like that. Meaning that England would then, you know, leave out James Vince perhaps. But the problem is they've got a huge issue with Moeen Ali, because Moe's got this cut in his spinning finger, which means as a bowler he's nowhere near as effective. And I also think number 6 is a place too high for him. So particularly against this Aussie bowler attack. So England have got a lot of stresses. And to be honest with you, I've been up all night and I don't have the brain power to kind of figure them out.
We weren't looking for any quick answers, Butch. We do understand there's some deep structural problems there with both sides, not just England, but Australia as well. Just to move away from cricket for a moment, just back to your music. I mean, a lot of cricketers, and Pez mentioned that at the start of the show, do fancy themselves as musicians, most of them being terrible. Brett Lee, Dwayne Bravo. I even think when I was preparing for this interview, I came across a YouTube video with Brett Lee was busking with Kumar Sangakkara, and they were singing "I Want It That Way" by the Backstreet Boys. So, and then I came across your work, which was actually a pleasant surprise because you're a proper musician in the truest sense of the word. And I get the feeling that it might even be a bigger passion for you than cricket. Would that be right?
Well, it certainly is now, mate. You know, one thing's for sure. I can still play guitar till I've come 90, but I've had more than enough of batting. So, I've always loved it. Always loved it. Played since I was probably about 12 years old. Always sung, always written. I'm working on I finished recording my second solo album. So I'm just waiting for some news about when that's going to go out. I'm involved in various other projects with other guys. You know, it's brilliant, isn't it? I've hopefully, fingers crossed, from the age of 17, I've not had a proper job, and I'm just working on making sure that I don't have one for the next. If I can get away with it for another 20 years, I'll be very happy.
That's awesome, and I do think it bears repeating that you're actually a genuine musician. You can actually do it, you know, people should check you out as well whenever they can.
Butch, well, that would be very nice.
Yeah, good. Butch, we'll move on to the segment of the chat that we like to call throwdowns. I suspect, you know, you're a long-term listener of the podcast, so you know exactly what we're talking about when we say that. But just in the slight chance you don't, we essentially wrap the joke up in the question and give you no opportunity to say anything of worth anyway. Very self-indulgent. But, yeah. You know, like any throwdown, some of them can be half volleys or be low full tosses, which you smash, and others are just... you know, slipped out of your hand or out your head. So let's see how we go, hey?
Nip back and hit you in the middle of the shin with no pads on. Yeah,
that's a much better way of saying it.
Yeah. Prepare for 16 of those.
I'll start off with, it's probably a bit more of a cliche one, but some won't know this. So Dave mentioned your father, Alan, before, a Surrey legend in his own right. He offered Steve Smith money to make him a Surrey player when Smith was 18. It would have excluded Smith from playing for Australia. Is your dad in some sort of witness protection program now?
No, but we do have some ties with Russia, so we can't talk about it.
Butch, if you had to pick one former teammate to do a duet with in the showers post game, who would it be, and why is it Darren Goff?
Well, he's got lovely blue eyes for a start.
So it's Pat Cummins, a lot of blue eyes, fast bowlers.
I might keep the music theme going, Butch. As you said, you started playing guitar at 12. I've read this on your website. Eric Clapton once said great stuff about your music. You're influenced by the likes of Al Green, Robert Cray, Freddie King, Mavis Staples, Stevie Wonder, Small Faces, Bonnie Raitt. You know, you play with a classy blend of heartfelt blues and soul. After 20 years of professional cricket, just how bad are the music tastes of other cricketers?
Oh, yeah, it's pretty bad. It is pretty bad. I know in Australia they're probably it's blasphemous to say anything bad about you too, but... the kind of the lack of imagination involved there is just mind-boggling. And the England team in teams of the sort of like the late 90s and 2000s, if it wasn't Oasis, it didn't exist either. So life was orally was pretty tough, as well as getting shunted by Australia every time.
I mean, who's got the best music taste? I mean, you mentioned playing with Damien Fleming at South Melbourne. I think he's a bit of a metalhead. Who's kind of had the most unusual musical influences of any cricketer that you've played with? Or the most cerebral, like, is there any kind of jazz aficionados?
Henry Alonga is an opera singer.
Right, he is, isn't he? Henry Alonga.
Yeah, Henry Alonga's an opera singer. Any jazzers? Not really. No, I mean, I'd probably, out of the guys I know, I've probably got more jazz LPs than anybody else. Mike Atherton, this may or may not be true, but Mike Atherton was a massive fan of the Benga Boys.
Oh. I think that's probably definitely true.
We're trying to get him on the show. We'll have to cross-reference this with him. That was my next question. I've also read that one thing you took away from your school days was a love of reading, speaking of all things cerebral, that you read anything and everything, and you love Graham Greene. And you've also said that Mike Atherton used to throw books at you. Is that a figure of speech, or is that a kind of a very Mike Atherton way of being aggressive?
Well, no, you know that was the way we used to call when running between the wickets, isn't it? Just lob a novel at me.
Arjuna Ranatunga had a snack, according to Ian Healy. You had Graham Greene novels.
Yeah, just 20th century literature.
Yeah, exactly. Called him the penguin, boom, boom.
Did this ever rub anyone up the wrong way? I mean, being a musician and someone who's into literature on tour, I mean, what do the other blokes think of this? I mean, Athers aside, if someone walked in the dressing room and you were, you know, elbows deep in a Graham Greene novel, how did people react to that?
Of Mice and Men.
Well, I mean, Athers would have been pretty happy with it. I mean, you know, most of the guys kind of have their thing. You know, there was a period of time when, in the first sort of half of my England career, so guys would take guitars away on tour. Funnily enough, when they were doing that, I didn't, because I just couldn't be dealing with it. But guys like John Crawley and Alan Mullally were teaching themselves. We had a physio called Wayne Morton who played. So, you know, there were lots of guys who were trying to amuse themselves sort of off the field. But no, I don't think so. You know, guys on trips in particular tend to understand that everybody needs to have their space a little bit. So,
I can relate to what you're saying there, Butch. I mean, even though I'm not a very talented musician at all, I do play a little bit of guitar. And it's something I enjoy, and I often try to ingratiate that into my own cricket, especially before I entered grade cricket, where that kind of thing is considered rare. I remember busking on a school cricket tour in the UK and Stratford-upon-Avon, the home of William Shakespeare. That's how rare I was, playing guitar outside Shakespeare's house on a cricket tour.
It was a lute, was it? You were trying to attract fair maidens from a balcony or something.
Yeah. Exactly what I was doing.
This is so different to the Brad Hogg interview. Sorry, Hoggy, if you're listening out there. No doubt you're not. Yeah. On the ball machine, probably still. You're a commentator, Butch. So just a straighter one here, you know, are Graham Swann's impressions as good as he thinks they are?
they've gone down well, haven't they? I've seen literally no people on Twitter saying how wonderful they are. The thing is actually I've been on sort of various trips with Swanny, sort of golf trips and whatever, and corporates and things like that, and he literally does have them rolling around after quite a lot of drugs, he is genuinely quite funny, but it's one of those things particularly, you know, the old lip mics and whatever, that stuff doesn't translate particularly well, I don't think, in the commentary box, or at least it hasn't yet. You know, maybe people are going to have to take a bit of a while before they get used to it.
Well, it's an interesting thing, Butch. I mean, there's a serious element to it as well, and I shouldn't just, Graham Swann impressions is a really low and easy target. One of the reasons I say it, and we ask a lot of people on this show who have commentary experience, is that a lot of these guys who are commentating, and I know you're one yourself, they have actually like really wonderful cricket brains, and they can say like their analysis is excellent, and I'd say that of Graham Swann as well. Like, I love listening to him talk about cricket. He knows spin bowling especially really well, but he also, you know, his views on sledging and the effectiveness of on-field verbal stuff, I think is really kind of, he's quite sophisticated as well. But there's clearly this element about commentary where producers must be prodding you to continue the kind of light entertainment. So not only do you have to be an expert in the content of what you're looking at, but you've also got to be this kind of like, Jimmy Carr, kind of late night TV guy as well. It must be difficult to combine entertainment with analysis.
It's not something. Listen, I'm old school in terms of the people that I remember, or you know, the voices that I remember at the summertime. Brian Johnson, John Arlott, I would have been very young at the time, but that sort of style of commentary whereby you're trying to augment the pitches as much as you can. And yes, there's time for a bit of humour and a bit of banter and whatever. But generally speaking, you know, Richie's old thing about trying to stay out of the way a little bit. You know, no matter what the sort of the pressure might be or the sort of like the current thinking on it, I still, that always is in my head when I'm doing it. And so, listen, I think there's a place for that and for the old school way of doing it, and there's also a place for the new school way of doing it. I just, you know, there are times, particularly in a test match, you know, it's a long old game, and the spaces in between are just as important, I think, as you know, constantly assaulting the viewer's ears. So I think you need to be careful with that.
Just one last one here, Butch, and we'll leave the throwdowns for another day. But while I was listening to your music today, I couldn't help but notice that your YouTube username is MB173. Now, this is obviously a self-indulgent reference to your 173 at Headingley in the 2001 Ashes series. Am I correct?
You might well be correct. Yeah, I can't pretend that was the only one that I had that was left. You know.
Yeah. 172. Yeah. Already.
Yeah. I thought you might be looking at 17870, which was your first class runs as well. But 173 would have to suffice. Can I wonder if
was it? Getting... Well, I'm glad you told me that.
Yeah,
we are numbers. Yeah, that's all we are.
It's all we'll ever be. Butch, thanks so much for joining the Grade Cricketer. You certainly lent a level of brain power to it that has probably been sorely lacking for quite a while, and we really appreciate having someone on from you know, who isn't Australian. So hopefully this can be start of a long and prosperous run of guests from other places. But appreciate you following us from so early on as well.
No worries. Well, I'll pass the word around for if you we'll encourage others to get on there, and also everybody to follow the Great Cricketer, because it's good stuff.
Oh, good on you, mate. Athers is next. If you're listening, mate. Athers,
use that as a soundbite.
it's great stuff.
It can be hard to leave grade cricket. The relentless nudity, champing, and macho horseplay can have a debilitating, lasting effect.
Hi, darling. How was your day?
Yeah, not bad, bud.
Can you please stop calling me bud?
So when you do call time on your 8-year, barely memorable career, you need all the help you can get. That's why we started the Grade Cricket Rehabilitation Centre. Using state-of-the-art cognitive behavioural therapy, the Grade Cricket Rehabilitation Centre will help you reintegrate back into normal society just like your family wanted.
Hello, darling. How was your day?
Good, thanks. And how was yours?
It was wonderful. You're coming along so well.
Yeah, cheers, champ. Wait. Thank you very much. I appreciate your help.
The Grade Cricket Rehabilitation Centre. There is a way out of this.
Hashtag AskTGC. Wow, it's been an amazing show this week, and some of our new sponsors have been wild, exciting, and every other adjective that you can think of. If you want to take the time to get in contact with us, if you want to slide into our DMs, if you want to follow us on social media, the Instagram machine, the Twitter machine, the Facebook, always use the hashtag AskTGC. It makes it a lot easier for us to find you. Of course, Tea and No Sympathy is out in bookstores right now. I tell you every week, but you want to get this before Christmas, because it's going to sell out before Christmas. So if you want the book, fucking get it now. All right. Lachlan Hancock writes in and he says, using the hashtag AskTGC, what's the point in training chest and pipes religiously if you don't go shirtless on Bill and Boz? That's a really good question, Lachlan. And I tried to go shirtless, but the producer said that I had to put a shirt on because yuck. So that's what he said. Dave Mathers, hashtag AskTGC. Hey, guys, I am struggling with the ladies, and I think it's my flavour of salad. Currently, I got long, curly leaves that reach my shoulders. Any ideas for new flavours of salad that will help me with the chicks? P.S. I got pipes, bowled part-time offies, and hit a long ball.
Right. Yeah, salad's really getting up there with Alpha and Champ, isn't it? Mm. You know, in the word cloud of TGC. There's something about just the sheer incongruity of like a bowl of salad and hair that still gets me. I don't know. And I'm the wrong person to ask anyway, for obvious reasons. Reasons we've already discussed.
Flavors of salad. I don't know, like ranch or like balsamic vinegar. Like, what's the latest salad rocking the airwaves in grade cricket anyway? Like a high top fade? I honestly don't know what people are wearing in grade cricket these days, salad wise. But you've got pipes and you hit a long ball, so you don't need a salad. You got enough.
Yeah, relax.
Do we need to talk about Michael Clarke's new salad that he's rocking on the Channel 1 commentary?
Yeah, I think so. I think we need
to. Fade he's got.
Rocking.
Sick fade. He was always different, wasn't he, Pup? That's what we had to understand. He was part of the new generation. He wasn't like the other captains, old Pup. He didn't drive up in his truck, his ute, and drink his VB with a case of 4X in the back, two different beers. I think that's what we're told to accept, and this is the case with his high-fade salad.
All right. Question asked and answered. Liam Maroney says, grade cricketer, just as a keeper wearing short sleeves is punishable under criminal law, and the champs deserve to rot in hell with Satan for all eternity, is there anything worse than a top-order bowler wearing long sleeves? These allies of Lucifer seem to occur in T20. Hashtag AskTJC. Dave, bowlers with long-sleeve shirts. Thoughts?
What is a top-order bowler? Like, I've never heard anyone. Like, what the fuck is
very
that?
Good.
Like, I'll just pick him up right there. As a top order bowler myself, I always wore short sleeves, mainly just to get a bit of sun ahead of the Saturday night circuit. That's the only way you can do it. You wear long white clothing for most of the day. So how else are you going to get any sun on those pipes, eh, boys?
God. We just have – this is like a call center, is it? We like literally just have a sheet up in front of us about how to deal with every scenario.
It's all scripted.
To do with pipes and levers and salads. I take a different view with this on long sleeves. Like it sort of seems decidedly like English to me. I like the idea of – I just think long sleeves is kind of – is high fashion in the cricket sense, and you could probably you kind of identify as somebody who can move the ball around a little bit. You might think a little bit differently about the game. Like if an older kind of seasoned player came on to bowl at me with long sleeves and they had a decent enough rig, I'd be thinking they can make the ball talk.
I think if you have a big chest and pipes, you should wear short sleeves as a top order bowler.
Just think about that.
But
if you're
kind of long and lanky, then a long sleeved shirt looks good. You know, like on like an Andy Caddick or someone like that.
Yeah, good question. Allies. I don't think they're allies of Lucifer.
I only faced two bowlers in my career who had long sleeves. One was Saklay Mushtaq, and that is a heavy name drop. You know what he did? He chucked it. The other guy, who was a medium pacer, and he also chucked it. If you're bowling with long sleeves, it means you're chucking it. That's what they're doing. They're masking. They're cheating, Liam. So thanks for asking. Steve Stevens, great cricketer. Has anyone ever seen Sam Perry and Chris Rogers in the same room together? It's the same voice on both people or the same person in both voices. It's uncanny. Pez, are you Chris Rogers?
Well, I can see, I guess, where Steve is coming from. You know, former opening batsman, athletes, chest pipes, colorblind, cricket analysts. You know what? Can I? I'll see you, your Saklay and Mushtaq name drop, and I'll semi-raise you. That's exactly what Pat Cummins said to me after I interviewed him. He's like, mate, you sound exactly like Chris Rogers. And I was like, I guess I'll take it. With grandstand and whatnot, he's on there.
Are you happy with that?
No, he doesn't have a baritone voice. He doesn't, and I'm insecure about my voice. John Lennon hated his own voice too, though. In my defence, I don't even know whether to kind of own this. Every time I own this insecurity, I kind of fire back with something as well. This is the great duality of being a cricketer. It's like, oh yeah, I'm vulnerable about it. Wait, John Lennon hated it too, so. I'm John Lennon.
I think in some capacity, people listen to this podcast because we represent the everyman, you know. And so far, we've name dropped in the last 35 seconds Saklay Mushtaq, Pat Cummins, and fucking John Lennon. So, yeah, okay. We're just the voice
and we're bigger than Jesus. Bill Woods.
All right, here we go. Some sports Nuffy. This is actually a really fascinating question, and I want to get both your opinions on this. So one at a time, please. To any dream interpreters out there, what does it mean when Toadie from Neighbours is ironing my whites? Is it referencing a good spread, a tee, or my slow running between wickets? Hashtag AskTGC.
I don't know, mate. I'm not a dream interpreter. When he said toady, I immediately think of that Uber Eats ad that's out at the moment. Piers, you wouldn't have seen this if you're in London. Toady's no. in a new Uber Eats ad where he's sipping a pineapple by the pool in like some hotel dressing gown. And he's waiting on his delivery from some Thai joint in Newtown. His rig is just not looking good. I'm not trying to body shame the bloke, but the Lord knows my rig could use some work. But fuck me, toady from Neighbours. Get your rig in check.
It's one of the better like cricket dreams I guess you could have, but when I think of Toady from Neighbours, I just think of that great kind of swipe over mid wicket he played in the opening credits of Neighbours as well in the street game.
Was Carl Kennedy bowling that?
Yeah, I think so, and there's a lot of people crowded around the bat, and he just absolutely leathers one with no footwork at all, just all eye, and I'm pretty sure it goes into Carl Kennedy's backyard, so you know, he's probably Alfred Carl Kennedy there, and if he's ironing your whites, then I think that's a pretty good sign.
Thomas David writes in, he says, "Good morning, TGC. I'm writing to seek advice on how I should handle an attempted alphering. I have a surname that is a common first name. So if it is not uncommon at the workplace for me to get emails where people will address me by my surname. I've been at my job now for about 7 months, and it's going well. One person... though, who sits about 10 metres from me and constantly calls me by my correct name to my face every single time he emails me and addresses me by my surname. Our emails have our photo on them, so he must know I am the same person. What should I do? Is he alphering me successfully? Is he trying to make a point that he doesn't care about my name? Or is he a bit insecure, the new guy, 20 years his junior, may be gaining more traction in the company and could quickly leap over him in the hierarchy, therefore he is trying to bring me down, back down to earth, by clearly displaying he doesn't care about my name. Any advice on how to handle this would be much appreciated. Cheers, Tom. P.S. He's South African, if that makes any difference as to how I should approach this."
Thanks for letting us know. That changes everything.
Yeah. Well, Pistorius.
It's an interesting one, he goes. I wonder whether he spent a lot of time in Japan, because over there they address others by their last name. I know that because I worked across East Asia for a few years, and the family name always comes first in those cultures when addressing others. It's pretty much the rule across East Asia in general. So calling someone by their first name is actually rude in some circumstances. I'm just wondering if you use the suffix San. David San.
I think that's what we all wondered when we read this question, whether it was Japanese. I think Thomas has well-founded fears about this. And I think one of the worst brands of alphaing is the kind of unintentional alpha as well. So I think, the subconscious alpha. So I do think that this person is alphaing him by just mixing up his names back and forth, but it's more of a mix-up than just a deliberate alpha issue, but still underlying it all is his disinterest in getting Thomas's name right, and I think that's where he needs to be worried.
I find this fascinating because, like, I think there could be a few levels here, though, boys, because, like, there's a photo involved in his email, so Thomas David is telling us via the hashtag RCGC that this person knows who he is. It's the same person. He sits 10 metres from him. He's a new guy, and he could be worried. Like, you can't be alphaed if it's an honest mistake. That's not an alphaing. Like, alphaing is, like, subverting someone deliberately. Like, that's what it is, like, as we know.
It's a slippery slope with the honesty of mistakes. Like, sometimes he might just be making... This is what I'm trying to say. Like, he might just be making a mistake without caring, and it's the non-caring that's the alpha expression going on.
Yeah.
So the honesty of the mistake is at play, and maybe Thomas needs to send him this exact question deal with it head on.
But what I'm saying, Pez, if this guy deliberately doesn't care... That's alpha. If he doesn't care about Thomas David as a person, then, like, that's an alpha move. Like, even if it's accidental, he doesn't care. The fact he doesn't care about other human beings, as South Africans, as we know, tend to do, that's just broad and ridiculous.
Oh, no. I don't know.
Come on, mate. And the emails, apparently, is this company's emails, they have their photo on them. Like, where is the email kind of like a small kind of, like a little one kind of in the corner, or is it like a big kind of email signature size infographic at the bottom? Like, how visible is his face in the photo is what I'm saying there. There's a lot of variables, and perhaps Thomas should write in next week with an extended question and we can answer it again and waste everyone's time for another 6 minutes.
I mean, if there's any... If there's anything we learn from this, is that like the phenomenon of alpha is a, like a very rich, complex place, and it will take us years to try and unravel it. But we try our best. Thank you, Thomas. David.
Shane Shane Earps writes in. He says, "Who is more alpha? A first grader who's a bit of more of a rare unit, has a sloppy rig and a small and small bodily features, or a fourth grade rigosaurus with serious chest and pipe game, is a renowned chop artist and has the big hands and hung piece combo. The principle the principle of be good or fuck off implies that it's the first grader. However, our broader celebrated definition of masculinity in Western society hints at the fourth grader. I'm at a loss. However, I think it is. I think this paradoxical hypothetical is exactly that. As we all know, that if you have levers and a good chop yarn to spin, you at least play twos. And if you're a pipeless rare specimen, you'd have about as much contact with the ones as you do with your dad. Fucking none, champ. Thoughts? Oh, that's a really interesting question, Shane.
I'm still reeling from some of the phrases this guy has used.
Rigosaurus?
A fourth grade rigosaurus.
Yeah, big hands and hung piece combo.
Hung piece combo. I'm reeling.
You can't
I'm
tell genuinely me reeling right, from though.
That. A chop artist as well. There's artistry in the chopping. I always thought it was just a kingdom. The chop king.
But let's try to get to Shane's point here. Like, who is more alpha is his question. The first grader who is nothing, or the lesser cricketer who plays four, but he's got the big hands hung piece combo, in his words.
Who's judging the alpha? Is this just in the onlooker, like, or a person in the club who's determining this decision on who is more alpha?
We're now the arbiters of alpha.
But we're
arbiters of alpha.
Side band.
Yeah. We're not involved in the club or the scenario. We don't know any of the individuals in this situation. So I don't know how well qualified we are to. Obviously, we'll have a crack, boys.
Yeah. I mean, look. This hits a little bit close to the bone for me. As a former first grader who was a rare unit, I would say, and I definitely had and still have a sloppy rig, and certainly I'd like my bodily features to be bigger. When I first read it, I saw myself in it. But what I can say, honestly, is whether I'm more alpha than a fourth grade rigosaurus, it's, you know... I've never been able to answer that.
I'm just picturing one of those like wax Tyrannosaurus rigs.
What am I doing with my life?
What are we doing on this podcast? Is this the end?
Of course.
Is this the end?
I don't know. I always worried about those fourth grade rigosauruses, you know.
You know how, like, test players talk about, like, they know when it was the end for them? Like, Pez, have you just reached the point? You just found it?
Can we delete the account tonight?
Yeah. I'll think about it.
Shane, I thought it was a wonderfully worded question. We don't have an answer for you. Pez is crying now, and he's left the show. Dave's shaking his head. And what better way to finish this at the end of the second test match of the Ashes series? Australia winning 2-0. That seems like a long, long time ago now. Enjoy the rest of your week. We've got a bumper show next week. We can't give too much away right now, but it's going to be huge. Hope you join us then. See you next week.